The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Lance M. Swalve. Swalve, all right, thank you. For the appellant, Mr. Swalve, is Mr. Philip Parent, an attorney from Madison. And for the state is Mr. Grant Gormley, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Parent, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court, counsel. I'll be talking a lot about facts today, and this really is a case about facts, much less so about the law. Lance Swalve was a man in his 30s who opened a car dealership first in Arlington, South Dakota in the fall of 2000, and then a second used car dealership in Watertown, South Dakota that same fall in September of 2000. He quickly built it into a high-volume car dealership. In fact, in the 12 months before his license was surrendered in November of 2002, the two dealerships combined sold 800 vehicles. Estimated gross sales between the two dealerships combined in that 12-month period of time. The estimates varied at trial, but it was between $8 and $11 million in a year's time of gross sales. So I mentioned that just to give the court a sense of the fact that this was a volume dealership that we're talking about, literally 800 cars, and charges brought concerning 50 of those vehicles. It was the defendant's position at trial that this was an issue of a failed business leaving debts unpaid, as opposed to an issue of theft by deception, which is what the state charged. And I'm going to go right to that point, because that is critical to the case, and that is the way the state charged the case, as theft by deception, as opposed to some other type of theft, such as theft by embezzlement of property received in trust. With theft by deception, and I want to acknowledge at this point that the jury was properly instructed, the jury had to find that the intent to deceive, the intent to defraud, the intent to take the money had to exist at the time that person traded that car in, or at the time that person bought that vehicle, or at the time that person purchased the extended warranty contract or extended service agreement, which was referred to loosely in the trial as a warranty. That is a critical point and brings me to the first issue that I argued in my brief, which was we had 11 counts that went to the jury where Mr. Swalve wasn't even the salesman. Arguably wasn't even present when the sale occurred. Now, I mention that not because it's critical, and in fact the state comes back and makes some references to the record that says, well, if he wasn't the salesman, he was there in the wings, or the salesman talked to him.
Just a minute. The rules of this court require the use of a camera that does not have a flash and is supposed to be silent. That has a flash and it has an irritating noise. Please quit using it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, counsel.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
The reason I brought those 11 counts to this court's attention is because if he wasn't even present, then how could he have intended to deceive if he didn't even know the sale was happening? Again, the intent to deceive had to be there at the point of sale, not at some later date when the loan funds came in to pay off that lien. That might have been theft by embezzlement.
Couldn't the jury have inferred that fact, though, from his conduct in making decisions as to when things should be paid, when checks should be cut, when they shouldn't, that type of thing? I mean, a jury could make that inference, couldn't they?
They would be inferring intent then at a date other than at the point of sale. They would be inferring intent at a point of sale by virtue of the fact that 10 days later when the loan proceeds came in, he chose to do something with the loan proceeds other than pay that lien off.
But that's something that we do and juries do every day, isn't it? They make inferences relating back based on subsequent conduct?
Yes, but of course the law of the state is, and the jury was properly instructed again, that they can't infer intent simply from the fact that that loan wasn't paid off when the funds came in. Now, they can't infer intent simply from the fact that a promise to pay wasn't subsequently fulfilled. And that is the law of the state. So, and again, I bring up those counts where Mr. Swalve wasn't the salesman just as an example, truly whether he was present or not isn't critical. I bring up those that where he wasn't present as an obvious case where if he didn't know the sale was happening because he wasn't present, how could he have had the intent to defraud at that point in time? The next category, and that was, there was 11 counts that went to the jury in that regard, by the way. One of the more interesting ones, Charmel Dahl, count 39. She was a dispatcher for the Watertown Police Department. She acknowledged under cross-examination she didn't even talk to Mr. Swaps for several months after the transaction happened.
Is that an element of the crime? I mean, can't he be charged for actions he's directed employees to take?
If there were evidence that he had directed the employees to take those actions, yes. And again, the trial court properly instructed that an officer of a corporation can be liable for acts of its agents if the jury were to find that this was part of an ongoing course of conduct directed by the defendant. That's not quite the language of the instruction, but that's the gist of it. And again, if there were some evidence that Suave had told his salesman, you know, make that sale to Charmel Dahl, and we're going to pocket her money and not pay off the lien on the vehicle she bought. But there wasn't such evidence.
How many counts was he charged with totally?
Originally, if memory serves, there were 38 felonies and 40 misdemeanors for a total of 78. The 40 misdemeanor counts would have been failure to deliver title, which would be a class 2. The 38 felonies were almost exclusively theft by deception. I believe there were 2 or 3 theft by embezzlement of property received in trust.
So the jury didn't convict him of all those counts?
Correct.
And so they were discerning enough to be able to sort them out?
That's a fair question to ask. But again, there's evidence in the record that questions that conclusion. And for example, counts 56, 57 involving Laurel Wiggs, both theft by deception, or pardon me, yes, theft by deception, both class 4 felonies, same date of offense, October 1st, 2002. She's found not guilty on the CNA warranty charge, the vehicle service agreement, but guilty on not paying off the lien on the trade-in. And so on one hand, yes, certainly a valid point, Justice, that you know, the jury considered carefully all the evidence, found him guilty on some, not guilty on others. But then we've got a case like Laurel Wiggs where the jury found apparently that at that point of sale, he intended to pocket the money that he took for the vehicle service agreement, he didn't intend to pocket the money that he took for the vehicle service agreement, but he did intend to not pay off the trade-in or the loan on her trade-in. And that's not the only example. Count 6061, Denise Bender. Not guilty on the CNA warranty charge, guilty on failing to pay, or theft by deception, by creating the false impression that he would pay off the lien on the vehicle that she bought.
But if the evidence, I mean, if there is some evidence to support it, some pattern evidence, are we invading the province of the jury to say, well, some of their decisions weren't logical, although there was evidence to support them?
If there is evidence to support them, and I understand this court's reluctance to invade the province of the jury, but there does have to come a point when the trial court and subsequently this court has to say, there's a line that has to be drawn. No evidence is no evidence. If there's no evidence of intent, even though a jury is properly instructed, we have to recognize that sometimes a jury will convict even when that threshold, bare minimum line of evidence of intent.
Seems to me that might be a pretty good argument if we were only dealing with, say, 3 or 4 or 5 charges. But here we have transactions over a substantial period of time, and we have the state producing evidence that your client had a special customer day where in order to get the cars back into the inventory, because there was going to be an audit or an inventory check, he gets all these cars back on the lot, so it makes it look like he has not defrauded somebody. So when you have an example like that, can't the jury, you know, look at all the evidence and infer that the decision to defraud, you know, came on the fifth vehicle, or the seventh vehicle, or the tenth vehicle, or for the next 50 or 40, you know? Maybe they weren't there for the first 36 or something. But isn't that evidence that can be inferred?
The customer appreciation days was raised in the state's appellee's brief, was certainly raised at trial. But if you look at the underlying testimony about customer appreciation days, perhaps not that exact practice, but the premise for that practice came, the briefs explain car dealers refer to floor planning, which is simply a trade term for obtaining financing for their inventory, the vehicles they have on the lot. One of Mr. Swab's floor planners would call the Watertown dealership and talk to Mr. Swab or one of his salespeople and say, my bank's auditor is coming to your lot to count cars that I've financed for you. Better make sure they're all there. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. There was no deception between Mr. Swab and his floor planner. In fact, this forewarning was brought about by his floor planner. The same floor planner that after Mr. Swab signed a promissory note for $460,000 to clear up any indebtedness to this floor planner still refused to deliver titles to 21 vehicles that ultimately went to the jury on a failure to deliver title charge. His business manager, his collections enforcer testified at trial, the floor planners that is, that yes, Mr. Swab had signed a promissory note as payment for the total indebtedness he owed to the floor planner. Yes, I know that South Dakota law provides that a purchaser for value in the ordinary course of business, you know, takes free of any liens of the creditor of the person selling the vehicle, but I'm still not going to deliver those titles until I get my money. Absolutely ignoring the fact that a promissory note is the money. Now, maybe it's not cash in hand, but it's payment for those vehicles for that credit. That brings me to the 21 titles held by Pioneer Auto, which Pioneer Auto refused to deliver to my client, which the state was ultimately able to recover. But that's 21 counts that went to the jury where my client had done all he could. He effectively made payment by signing this promissory note and collateral real estate mortgage. He'd advised the floor planner, these vehicles are sold, I need the titles. And when the floor planner refused to deliver the titles, he went to the Watertown police detective and asked for help and was told, I'm sorry, that's a civil matter. We can't help you. He had done everything he could to procure those titles. He had arranged for payment. He had sought help from the state. He was without ability, through no fault of his own, in a legal sense, to deliver those titles. Now, it's easy to say, well, he simply could have paid for the cars to the floor planner, Mr. Bussey. But in a legal sense still, he did. He signed that promissory note. And just to point out a little more about the confusion that was apparent to the jury, I want to talk about the eight counts that went to the jury regarding the extended service agreements, the CNA warranty agreements, as they were referred to. We've got eight counts that went to the jury over a relatively tight period of time. We've got the same facts behind each of them. The service agreement is sold during a given month, pick September, pursuant to the terms of the agreement with CNA. Payment was supposed to be remitted for that service agreement on the 10th of the month following. So if the service agreement was sold in September, October 10th, CNA's portion of the price of that service agreement was to be remitted to CNA. We've got this group of eight counts that went to the jury, identical circumstances, and Mr. Swaz found guilty on five, not guilty on three. I believe I misspoke in the appellant's brief in that regard. I correctly stated, though, and identified those counts in the reply brief. We've got eight counts that are identical. And for no apparent reason, the jury found not guilty on three and guilty on five. At some point, the number of counts, I believe, simply overwhelmed the jury. And
the if they'd state been overwhelmed, though, to repeat, in essence, Justice Meyer Henry's question, wouldn't they have just gone all one way or all the other? It looks to me like they took each one individually, and I don't see how that equates with overwhelming.
And if the state could point to some particular point of evidence that explained why they found Mr. Suave not guilty on the CNA warranty claim for Denise Bender, but guilty on the theft by deception for not paying off the lien on the vehicle she bought, if they could point to one point of evidence that the jury could have hung its hat on, yes, I would agree with that argument, but they can't. And those three that I, or pardon me, two cases that I gave you, counts 56, 57, counts 60, 61, are great examples of that. There's nothing in the record. There's no bit of evidence to suggest what differentiated those two transactions that took place on that October 1st day, on that October 5th day. There's nothing to differentiate why he would have had intent to defraud by not paying off the loan on the trade-in, yet not intent to defraud on the CNA warranty claim. And then the same thing with the October 5th counts, 60-61 on Denise Bender. I understand that it's a difficult argument to make, but it is truly not a question of law. The jury was properly instructed, but on the other hand, it is a fundamental question of law. Did the state produce evidence? Did they meet that minimum threshold which puts it in the province of the jury? And in the cases that I've tried to, in the counts that I've tried to point out in my brief, I've tried to identify specific counts. I realize this is a complicated case. I remember on day two of the trial, we went through 28 witnesses. I believe over 60 witnesses testified at all. We had 78 counts, as was pointed out earlier, to begin with. And that's why in my brief I've tried to identify specific counts and be as specific as I could to point out the absence of evidence. And again, going back to those CNA claims, the warranty claims, going back to the two examples I gave of on the same transaction with the same person, not guilty on one, guilty on the other. I want to take just another minute, and I realize I'm running short on time here, and talk about the search and seizure issues. Brief history. Originally, Suave was charged with three felonies, at the time represented by a different counsel. That counsel, in the spring of 2002, I believe in early May of 2002, filed a suppression motion arguing the search warrant was invalid. The trial court granted that motion. Subsequent to that, at that hearing, Chief Counsel for the Department of Revenue explained why the search warrant was necessary, because it was necessary to obtain information they didn't otherwise have. Even after the search warrant was suppressed and the evidence was ruled invalid and the evidence obtained by it suppressed, the prosecutor on the case, when explaining why he hadn't yet returned the property that was seized by the search warrant, said, "We're still working on it. We're still going through it. We're still developing evidence from it." With those kind of comments, it just seems absolutely ingenuine for the state to come back and then say, "No, we gained all this evidence independently." When Chief Counsel for the Department of Revenue, when the person actually prosecuting the case, says, to begin with, "We need this evidence," and then after the courts ruled this evidence is inadmissible, to say, "We still want to hang on to it for a while because we're still going through it and trying to develop our case." And it just seems absolutely ingenuine for them to come back later then and say, "Oh no, we didn't use that evidence to develop our case." Now, the trial court did find on three counts that there was no independent source, and the trial court did grant the motion to suppress on three of those counts. And again, I recognize the discretion and deference given to the trial court on this issue, and that's with good reason. But I think the trial court forgot its own memorandum decision that was issued that preceding spring and forgot the testimony of counsel for the Department of Revenue, forgot the comments made by the prosecutor when ruling that no, there was an independent source for this evidence, or that this evidence had somehow been procured legally as a result of the initial investigation of Mr. Suave. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parent. Mr. Gormley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I would like to begin with the issues involving the judgment of acquittal. It seems to me that a fair amount of the arguments attempting to turn the legal principle on its head. The legal principle, as we all know, is that you look at the evidence that supports the verdict. You don't look at the evidence that argues that somehow the verdict was improper. And if I might, going from that, I think the first thing to look at in my mind is to look at the judgment of acquittal on the issues where the defendant, in effect, promised that he was going to pay off the loans that were made on the trade-in vehicles and did not do it. He lists the numbers of the counts that he's concerned about. I would have thought that if the defendant thought that there was something improper here, he would have challenged all of the counts that dealt with this particular issue, but he didn't do that. What he did is took some of them and left others aside. The ones that he left aside, I would have to believe he's in effect admitting that he had the intent to defraud at the time that he entered into the agreement.
Now, your opposing counsel has said there is no evidentiary basis to distinguish these counts, some of which the jury acquitted on and some which they convicted on. Right. Is there an evidentiary basis? Because that is part of our standard review.
I'm not sure that the evidentiary basis is all that clear, but I would argue that what has to be done is the jury was instructed, they were told properly how to look at this, and the jury said there were some that were convictable and some that were not. I don't pretend to know how it is they decided which were and which weren't. The point is, the issues that are in front of the court today are the counts that they convicted on. We're not here to argue about what they did with the counts that they didn't convict on. All we're trying to do is uphold the counts that they did convict on. And since those are the issues that are in front of the court, then I think it's important to look only at those, and the defendant isn't looking at all those. He's only looking at some of them. And to go to what Justice Sabre said earlier, I think what you said makes absolute sense. You might run into a situation that you have a pattern over a period of time, and you might start out possibly not intending to defraud, and then maybe at some point you intend to defraud and the later counts would work out that way. What we have in this case is just the opposite. The counts that he is not challenging, that he is in effect admitting that he intended to defraud on, are earlier counts in August. And he's challenging counts that occurred in September and October. He doesn't challenge counts 3, 33, and 37. And those counts, for the most part, are earlier counts than the ones he is challenging. Now, I don't understand the argument that says, I was a crook in the beginning, but somehow later on in this process, I wasn't a crook anymore. I intended on defrauding somebody in the beginning, but then I changed my mind and I wasn't going to defraud after that. And these are all counts that the jury convicted him on, not the counts that the jury didn't convict him on. So I have to say again, why would the defendant not claim that he did not intend to defraud on any of the counts? He seems to say that in general, but if you go back in the record and you look at all the counts, which takes quite a while to do, and you look at the dates, you find out that the early counts he isn't complaining about by and large, and the later counts he is complaining about. It makes no sense. And I would say that's pretty good evidence why the jury might decide that if he was a crook to begin with, he was a crook all the way through. He didn't decide not to become a crook in the middle. Furthermore, much of what the argument here is on these issues is involved with the salesman did it, not me. And if you look at the counts that he's complaining about and claiming, I guess, he had nothing to do with it. On counts 55 and 55A, Vicki Hammer said that the salesman got telephonic approval from the defendant prior to finalizing the agreement on the sale. On 57, Laurel Wiggs testified the defendant was present and answered several of the salesman's questions before the agreement was signed. On 65, Robert Steffen testified the salesman asked defendant a few questions during negotiations, which arrived at the sales agreement, and on and on and on. He was the boss, he knew what was going on, and to suggest that he had nothing to do with these sales as the sales transactions were being discussed just doesn't fit the testimony that's in the record. And again, on this basis, it seems to me the jury could say, claim all you want that you had nothing to do with any of this, that's not what the record shows. And finally, and I think we talked about a little bit earlier, or it was talked about a little bit earlier, customer appreciation days. And that this doesn't show fraudulent intent on the part of the defendant. He has a Watertown dealership. He takes cars from Highmore, puts them on his lot, and sells them. And when he sells them, he's supposed to tell Highmore, so they can give the title to the person that buys them, and he's also supposed to give them their cut of the money. So what he does is he sells them and he doesn't say anything to Highmore. Then Highmore decides at some point in this process, we want to check on our inventory. And they send one of their employees down to check on the inventory, and a bunch of the Highmore vehicles are missing. And they say to Suave, where are the vehicles? And Suave says, well, a bunch of customers came in and they took them out overnight to test drive them, so they don't happen to be here. So that explains why we don't have your vehicles. From now on, why don't you call ahead and tell us when you're going to come and check on the vehicles, check on your vehicles. So they said, fine. They call him a day ahead or whatever. They call up the customers who bought the Highmore vehicles and said, we have customer appreciation days. Bring your car in and we'll clean it for you. And that way the cars are sitting on the lot, the Highmore cars are sitting on the lot at the time they come to check on their inventory. Fraudulent intent.
Mr. Parent says that basically Highmore was in on the deal, if I read it right.
Highmore wasn't in on the deal because when it came time to give the titles to the people, Highmore said, give me my money. We're not turning over any titles until we get the money. So they didn't know to that extent. And furthermore, I think the record will show, and it's mentioned, I believe, in the state's brief, there was an attempt by Watertown, in effect, to bribe the Highmore guy that came to look at this. We can maybe do something for you if you don't tell your boss you didn't find what you were supposed to find. That would suggest to me that Highmore was not in on the deal. That record does not show that Highmore was in on the deal. And in fact, we can sit and argue about, was there intent to defraud at the time you sold the cars? Was the intent to defraud later? I think the intent to defraud was at the time you sold the cars. And the evidence of that, in part, are these customer appreciation days. Why would you tell somebody, next time you come, be sure and call ahead and check and let us know that you're coming so we can get the cars back if you're not planning on selling some of their cars and not telling them and taking advantage of this situation, which was exactly what happened. It's certainly reasonable for the jury, I believe, under circumstances like this, to conclude that there was fraudulent intent throughout this process. Now, there are a couple other judgment of acquittal issues here that are, we end up breaking down. We break it down to, now we have the extended warranties. And with the extended warranties, we have the same problem. The warranties problem is coming up later. Before that, we already have intent to defraud on the decisions not to pay off the loan on the trade-in vehicle. That all occurred previously. So again, I was a crook earlier, and I intended to cheat you when it came time to pay off the trade-in on your vehicle, so that people ended up getting bills for the one they traded in and bills for the one they bought, and they weren't going to notice that. But I maybe intended to cheat you there, but when it comes to these warranties, I didn't intend to cheat you at all. This doesn't make any sense, and it's a pattern. If this happened one time, maybe you could understand that there could be some mistake or error. What happened was, they sell extended warranties, and in effect, they get the retail value for these warranties from the buyer, from the purchaser. And then what they do is give the wholesale price to the warranty company, and they get to keep the difference. Well, they just decide to keep the whole thing, and did not buy those warranties, and they didn't find out about it till later. And then later on, this national warranty company says, we've got a reputation here. We never saw this money. They never saw the money for the warranties by the day of trial. They said, but we got a reputation here. We're going to stand behind these warranties. And they provided warranties to these people. And now the defendant, I think in his brief, says, hey, he got his warranties. What's the problem here? The problem is that he cheated them when he told them he was going to give them these warranties and took their money for the warranties and never bought them for them. So again, we have a similar situation. Then we have a third situation, which is the title, which is a different thing. You have to give them a title within 30 days. That's not a specific intent crime. That's a general intent crime. He admits he didn't give them the title. He never got the titles. And he says, it's not my fault I didn't give them the titles. I asked Highmore to give me the titles so that I could give them to the people I sold this to. And Highmore wouldn't turn them over, so it's Highmore's fault. Highmore didn't give them titles because Highmore had gotten cheated. They said, where's our money? We're not turning over titles until we get our money. And so the defendant says, that's Highmore's fault. That's not my fault. Well, the defendant didn't give titles to people that bought vehicles that weren't Highmore vehicles. So what's the excuse then? Highmore didn't give me the titles to vehicles where they didn't have the titles in the first place. The point is, there's a pattern of being a crook, whether it's the Highmore cars or it's not the Highmore cars. He was being a crook on all kinds of cars. And so to suggest that somehow I'm not a crook because it's Highmore's fault, when he did the very same thing when it wasn't Highmore's fault, would suggest that the jury could reasonably conclude that he intended to be a crook on all of it. And that's exactly what he did. So we have problems with all of these. But in every case, the jury makes its decision, and they make a reasonable decision, and there are facts in the record upon which they could conclude, and did conclude, that he was guilty of a number of these crimes. The last one that was discussed, if there aren't any questions on those, was the motion to suppress. And I think the important thing about the motion to suppress is that the state was already doing its investigation before there was ever a search warrant that's being objected to. On November 21st of 2002 and December 4th of 2002, they went to his place of business, went to his computer, got all kinds of information, and were already investigating because of problems that arose. On December 6th, they contacted the warranty company. And it wasn't till December 9th that they got a search warrant to look in a trailer that he had. And they said in testimony, we then never looked at any of that evidence. We gave it a little bit of a cursory look on December 16th. The point is, they were already doing an investigation. They'd already gotten lots of evidence from the defendant and his place of business, and they had already contacted the warranty company before they ever got this search warrant. So, and I think at some point in his brief, the defendant says, well, you know, how can you blame us on the warranty company deal? How can you not say that all that was a problem because they got information about the warranty company? They had talked to the warranty company and gotten information in part before they ever brought the search warrant that was declared to be bad. Now, there's a little bit of a problem in what occurs here because the judge at one point, when they're discussing whether the search warrant of the trailer is any good, say it's not any good. and there's not any way it can be any good. And then later on, about 6 months later, they have another motion to suppress on the counts of the indictment. And on that motion to suppress, the judge's ruling seemed to say the search warrant is okay to some extent. And so then what the judge does is says, I'm going to suppress the evidence on three of the counts where the evidence that came from the trailer applied to those three accounts. But in effect, I'm not going to suppress it on all the other accounts because, in effect, he's saying, I don't think that what came from the trailer impacted those counts. So he does that and makes a judgment that some counts are dropped and some not. Now, if the information that came before the search warrant was ever used in this case at all, it seems to me we're not into a suppression of the search warrant case. If the facts didn't come through the implementation of the search warrant, I don't see how suppression of the search warrant has anything to do with those facts and that evidence that goes into this conviction. So then, assuming all that's thrown out, we don't have to worry about whether this is inevitable discovery or independent source or anything else. Seems to me that only comes up if you got a search warrant problem and the evidence from the search warrant's bad. That's not what's happening here. But assuming that it is, assuming somehow that all the evidence is somehow tainted, which I don't think is correct, then we get into this, into the search warrant issue, and then you've got the independent source doctrine, I would argue. How can it not be an independent source if you went and got evidence before the search warrant came up? If you're going to argue the search warrant is bad, then this stuff has an independent source because it doesn't have anything to do with the search warrant. Is the way it looks to me in terms of the process. So I don't see that there's any problem on that search warrant either. If there aren't questions, I don't have more. There is a fifth issue, and I was not responded to in the reply brief. I think the state would just rely on its brief in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Gormley.
Well, just one question. What about the sixth issue that relates to the court allowing an undisclosed witness to testify during the state's case in chief?
Okay, that's one. All right. In that case, there was a master list given months in advance of the trial that says, here are all the witnesses. One of the witnesses on that list was a guy from the warranty company, from the National Warranty Company, who was going to come in and tell what happened. When it came time to have the trial, he didn't testify. One of his co-workers testified, who was basically going to give the same evidence that he was going to give. And the defendant said, wait a minute, we didn't know anything about the co-worker. And the state said, well, you knew about the guy who was going to testify for the warranty company. That ought to cover it.
Was his deposition ever taken?
Of the guy who testified? No. In fact,
the guy who was scheduled to testify.
I doubt it, but I couldn't swear to that. I don't know.
How do you know
for
then that the testimony was so similar?
There's no suggestion that there was going to be anything from the warranty company except whether they got money and whether they provided warranties. That was the point of anybody from the, they wouldn't know anything else about the case. That's all they know about it. And they knew about the original, they knew the warranties, those were the charges, they knew the warranty company was involved in all this, they knew about a witness from the warranty company that was not used. And it would seem to me that, the law would say you have to show some prejudice here, and there's certainly no suggestion of prejudice. All that the defendant ever says is, aha, gotcha, I got a technicality for you here, we weren't told about this guy. They didn't ask for a continuance. They didn't ask to have some ability to talk to this guy before he got up and testified. So they didn't do anything to try to preserve this or make any suggestion that they thought this was anything other than a gotcha.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Parent, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I want to first address the issue of not raising all the counts upon which there were convictions in my brief. As this court might imagine, one of the difficulties of presenting this case to a jury or defending this case to a jury is much the same as presenting this case to this court. The sheer numbers were overwhelming. And the concern that I realize this court sometimes has cases presented to it by other than trial counsel. Well, as is clear, I was trial counsel. And the concern from my point of view representing Mr. Suave is, how do I make this case specific for the jury? How do I get them to look at each case? And here I find myself, or at each count, here I find myself fighting the same battle in front of this court. I lost track of how many times counsel referred to my client as a crook. Certainly, my client denies guilt on all the counts. He did make a motion, a general motion, for a judgment of acquittal. But I just want to explain that I tried to make the case as specific as I could for this court, to encourage this court to look at the individual counts. Let's talk about customer appreciation days again. I mean, why is that brought up? Well, because it creates this general atmosphere of Mr. Suave being a crook. Now, I've said it twice. Does that give specific evidence of specific intent? No. It says collusion between the floor planner and Mr. Suave to convince the floor planner's bank that those cars are still there while Suave, through his dealerships, tries to generate the funds to pay off the floor planner so the floor planner can pay off his bank.
Isn't that evidence, though, of specific intent? They got the money for the cars and they haven't remitted?
Go back to what the specific intent is. The specific intent to defraud Charmel Dahl at the time she bought that vehicle, I don't see how that can be inferred from this other thing that's going on between Suave and his floor planner and his floor planner's bank. Now, counsel asks, you know, why would Suave call the floor planner and say, hey, let me know next time you're coming to do a car count? Well, the better question is, why would the floor planner call and say, hey, I'm coming to do a car count? Because it was a collusion between the two of them. That's why. It wasn't Suave deceiving the floor planner. If anything, it was the floor planner deceiving his bank. I want to talk just a minute about the extended service agreements again. Number one, and counsel's got it basically right, let's say the service agreement's $1,400. I believe the testimony was there was roughly 100% markup. In other words, on a $1,400 service agreement, $700 would be remitted to CNA or whatever the warranty provider would. But that $700 was not due until the 10th of the month following. In fact, the testimony at trial was that it was common and tolerated by CNA for that 10th of the month payment to be paid late, perhaps 30 days late, perhaps more late. But nonetheless, the testimony at trial was that CNA didn't have any problems with Suave until the day he surrendered his license. So, you know, we're talking about a matter of contract between Suave, or actually between Knipes Implementing, which is the Watertown dealership, which is actually, the contract was between, the Arlington Knipes Implement and CNA. It wasn't even with the Watertown store. But we're talking about a matter of contract that, all right, product you sold during the month has to be paid, you have to pay us by the 10th of the month following. So if there's a point of intent, it's on the 10th of the month when that money isn't remitted. It's not when the sale's made. And I know I keep coming back to that, but with the way Suave was charged, that truly is the critical issue, is intent at the time of sale. And that just surfaces again and again, whether it's in the CNA counts, whether it's on the vehicles that were traded in, or whether it's on the vehicles that were sold. It goes back to proof at the time of sale. On the search issue, just for one moment, I made a comment earlier that I think the trial court perhaps should have referred back to its own previous ruling. if the this court would refer to the trial court's memorandum decision of May 15th, 2003, which is attached to the appellant's brief, the trial court found in that May decision that the state, as of the time the search warrant was issued on December 9th, had identified 33 victims. That seems to contradict the trial court's later finding that all but three of the counts were identified independently. If as of the time the search warrant was issued, December 9th, 2002, the state had only identified 33 victims, then where did they come up with this other 20, I think it was? Again, the numbers are tough to recall exactly, but I believe there were 58 individuals identified in the complaint and subsequent indictment. So that finding in the court's memorandum decision alone would seem to contradict its later finding in December of 02 that, December of 03, that there was an independent source for all but three of the counts. Again, the reason why I didn't try to just blanket argue all of the conviction counts is because I wanted the court to focus on the specific counts and the lack of evidence on those counts. And that was the only way I could see to try to get away from the blanket statements that my client's a crook, the generalizations that go along with that, and try to focus on the individual counts in the absence of evidence on those individual counts.
How was your client prejudiced as a result of the fact that they called to trial Rick Jones instead of Mike Schmidt, whose name was on the witness list?
Okay. I want to clarify something first before I address that, if I may, and I've got a minute or two here, so I'll try to be quick. Much was made at the trial level of the fact that the state had provided counsel with what it called the big witness list. Well, this was like 187 names. I pointed out to counsel that no, the court's order requires you to provide a list of the witnesses you intend to introduce at trial. Well, that is the list I was pointing to in seeking to have Rick Jones's testimony precluded. Beyond that, Your Honor, I would say that in trying to be candid and honest with this court as best I can, I am arguing, as counsel pointed out, a technicality, an aha. I'm not claiming surprise by Rick Jones's testimony. I am saying he wasn't on the list and he wasn't disclosed as he was required to be by the trial court.
Right, but the question was, how are you prejudiced as a result of that?
Fair enough. I would have to say that if Mr. Jones's testimony wasn't a surprise, then my client was probably not prejudiced.
Thank you.
Anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curran. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.